black man, you're an African. No mind your nationality, you have got the identity of an African. 'Cause if you come from Clarendon, and if you come from Portland, and if you come from Westmoreland, you're an African. So don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African. No mind your nationality, have got the identity of an African. 'Cause if you come from Trinidad, and if you come from So don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African. No mind your complexion, there is no rejection, you're an African. 'Cause if your flexion high, 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 if your flexion low, and if your flexion in between, so don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African. No mind denomination, that is only segregation, you're an African. 'Cause if you go to the Catholic, so don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African. No mind your nationality, I've got the identity of an African. 'Cause if you come from Brixton, and if you come from Eastgate, and if you come from Wednesday,
African princess, so lovely African damsel. I love your style, I love the way you yet. Oh now, oh, oh. For your eyes are just like a dove, and it gives me eternal love. Your black complexion is a beauty to the nation. Oh yes, your black complexion is a beauty to the nation. Sweet African princess, a cool African damsel. Oh, oh, I love the way you get, I love the way you tread, yeah, man. Say you mean more to me, my love, than silver and gold. For your eyes are just like a dam, and it gives me eternal love. Your black complexion is a beauty to the nation. Oh yes, your eyes are just like a dove, and it gives me eternal love. Your black complexion is a beauty to the nation. Give me free me African princess, a lovely African damsel. Yeah, I love the way you tried, I love the way you vibe. Oh now, African, give me free me African damsel, a lovely African sister. African, oh, yeah, now, African princess, African princess. I'm Shema Japheth from you, an African princess. Hold your vibe, hold your head apart from your African children. African princess, go there, African damsel.
This is the foundation. Our rising population needs sound education to be recognized anywhere you go. You gotta have your certificate to show. To enjoy any kind of happiness, knowledge is the key to success. Children go to school and learn well. Otherwise, later on in life, you go catch red hell. Without an education in your head, your whole life will be pure misery. You're better off dead. For there is simply no room in this whole wide world for an uneducated little boy or girl. Employment, you must be intelligent. So it's essential, very essential, to have your credentials. But if you're blockheaded like a mule, remember no one will employ a fool. You will be the last one to be hired, and the very first one to be fired. Children go to school and learn well. Otherwise, later on in life, you go catch red hell. Without an education in your head, your whole life will be pure misery. You're better off dead. For there is simply no room in this whole wide world for literacy, illiteracy is man's weakness anyway. It's your duty, yes, your duty, stamp it out completely. Ignorance always in progress. Education saves you much stress. So learn, learn, learn as much as you can. This nation's future is in your hands.
Children go to school and learn well.
Otherwise later on in life you will catch real hell.
Without an education in your head,
your whole life will be pure misery, you're better off dead. For there is simply no room
in this whole wide world
for an uneducated little boy or girl. Don't allow idle companions to lead you astray. To earn tomorrow, you've got to learn today. It's a treasure, yes, a treasure beyond any measure. So secure it, just secure it, don't ever ignore it.
I said the fight, life's battles come what may. Education will light up your way.
Without it, you'll never, never, never get through. Success or failure, now it is up to you.
Children go to school and learn well.
Otherwise later on in life you won't catch real hell.
Without an education in your head,
your whole life will be pure misery, you're better off dead. For there is simply no room
in this whole wide world
for an uneducated little boy or girl. Don't allow
Sundays from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Sounds with me, Ron Bob Semple. A relaxing 3 hours of music from around the world. Music is the food of love. So tune in every Sunday evening from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Golden Sunday Sounds.
Get your news, views, and interviews which affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals by tuning into the Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple here on the Uhuru Radio Network.
Tune into Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 a.m. on the Uhuru Radio Network. We examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. If you're not listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network, then your radio is not on.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Hi, I'm Alan Bomar Jones, and you're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple.
History, as I think everyone here will recognize, is perhaps the most contentious of all subjects. But the fact that history is a contentious subject, subject to varying interpretations, is no reason, I believe, to justify the effort which has become somewhat widespread in recent years to attempt to criminalize dissenting historical opinions, to either criminalize those opinions literally or sometimes to subject those who hold differing opinions to widespread vilification. So I endorse the notion then of real history. History is controversial, it is contentious, but differences of opinion, I think, in the historical profession ought to be debated, ought to be fought out in the broad arena of ideas, and hopefully in time the correct ideas will prevail, hopefully, and incorrect ideas will die. The topic which I hope to deal with today is the controversies, recent controversies surrounding the question of the African slave trade, that is the slave trade in African people across the Atlantic Ocean. So that's the controversies which have arisen surrounding that question of the transatlantic slave trade. Slavery, as we know, has been historically an almost universal institution. I suspect that there must be very, very few societies that have not, at one time or another, experienced slavery. Karl Marx argued that slavery was one of the basic stages that Western European society went through after what he called primitive communism and preceding feudalism and so on. As one looks around the world at other societies, one sees examples of slavery just about every place. Slavery in ancient Greece is very well known. There's a very famous quotation from the Roman politician and man of letters, Cicero, in which he wrote to some friend of his one time, suggesting to that friend that when he went to buy slaves, that he should avoid buying English slaves because they were so stupid, ignorant. He thought that a guy would be wasting his money. In fact, it's very fascinating because the kinds of stereotypes that Cicero was putting forward in relation to English slaves were not that different from the kinds of stereotypes that developed later on pertaining to African slaves. So slavery then has been a very universal experience. Nevertheless, it has been a very controversial experience, and it continues to be a very controversial experience. One of the very first controversies surrounding slavery is a question of defining slavery. What precisely is slavery? A variety of different types of human condition have been described over the years as slavery. For example, serfdom in Europe has been described on occasion as being slavery. Sometimes, when speaking of the African situation prior to the transatlantic slave trade, sometimes historians have used the expression domestic slavery to try to differentiate the kind of so-called slavery that existed on the African continent prior to the transatlantic slave trade with what eventually developed in the Americas and elsewhere. Domestic slavery is said to have been something akin to domestic servitude, where those who were slaves had a certain amount of social mobility and weren't necessarily subjected to the kind of harsh regime that developed in the Americas later on. We have the term slavery applied to what in some history books has come to be known as white slavery, the white slave trade. I believe it was 1910 in the United States of America when an act was passed against so-called white slavery, the Mann Act. I think it was 1910. And white slavery supposedly was a slave, not supposedly, it was a trade in women, many of whom apparently were Jewish women coming out of Central Europe, and a trade which, notwithstanding the fact that the women were Jews, a trade which apparently was prosecuted by Jewish entrepreneurs. It was a global trade in which apparently women were sent from Europe across the world to act as prostitutes and so on. This was in the 19th century and into the early 20th century.
Tune in to our second annual Uhuru Radiothon Saturday and Sunday, May 5th and 6th. We continue to raise much-needed funds for improving the operations of your community.
With Take Back the Land and the Omojo Village. You are listening to Uhuru Radio, the online voice of the International African Revolution.
Hi, I'm Alan Beaumar Jones, and I encourage you to support the Uhuru Radio Network because it's independent, it's community, and it's pro-black.
Need to hear some soothing sounds of yesterday from around the world? Then listen to Golden Sunday Sounds with Ron Bob Semple every Sunday from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on the Uhuru Radio Network.
You're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple here on the Uhuru Radio Network.
The most important, however, of all of these rationales that was advanced to try to justify the slave trade was the question of this Hamitic myth. That is, the notion that Africans were cursed by God himself, that Africans had been cursed by God, that God had decreed in his wisdom a very long time ago that Africans would be forever the hewers of wood and the drawers of water for other races. The authority for this idea was said to reside in the book of Genesis, in a story in the book of Genesis. Now, that there's a story in the book of Genesis, and there's an interpretation of that story that allowed it to be used to justify African slavery. And they're two different things. The story in Genesis is in Genesis. It's been in the Bible ever since. But the sort of spin that was put on that story that enabled it to become the basis for the Hamitic myth actually comes out of the Talmud, the Jewish holy book, the Talmud. Somewhere around 500 AD or thereabouts, the Babylonian Talmud. Let me just describe the difference between the story as it appears in the Bible and the story as it was spun in the Talmud. According to the Bible, Noah, after the flood, apparently had a vineyard someplace, and he partook of the wine that was produced out of his vineyard. He got himself drunk one night, went into his tent, took his clothes off, as people often do when they get drunk. And according to the biblical story, he had three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. Ham apparently entered the area where his father was lying in his drunken, naked stupor. And Ham, in an act of disrespect, gazed upon his father's nakedness. And apparently went back outside and informed his two other brothers of his father's condition. According to the biblical story, the two other brothers then came inside the tent or wherever. And out of respect for their father, they kind of backed into the tent. They would not look directly at him in his naked condition. They backed into the tent. They covered him with some kind of a garment. And according to the biblical story, when Noah revived, when he, you know, arose from his drunken stupor and realized what had happened, he then cursed Ham's son Canaan and all of his descendants forever, and said that they would be the servants of the descendants of the other two brothers, Shem and Japheth. Somewhere along the line, I'm not quite sure how it came, but somewhere along the line, somebody came up with the notion that Ham was the progenitor of the African race, and Shem was the progenitor of the Asian race, and Japheth was the progenitor of the European race. So Noah had three sons of three different races, and he cursed his African son and their descendants, and said that those descendants would be the slaves, the servants of the Asian branch of the family, and also the European branch of the family forever. And that's as far as the biblical story goes. The Talmud, which of course, my understanding of the Talmud, I'm no expert on the Talmud, but my understanding is that the Talmud consists of interpretations, what they call glosses, on various biblical stories. And these glosses or interpretations or spins are supposed to give people who subscribe to the Judaic religion a sort of an authoritative guide as to how to interpret the biblical stories and whatnot. So what the Talmud did then, the Talmud came along, the Babylonian Talmud, around about 500 or so AD, and proceeded to spin this biblical story, and for reasons that are unknown to me. But Ham, again, was said to be the progenitor of the African race. Now, interestingly enough, I read someplace that early Christians also accepted this notion of Ham being some sort of progenitor of the African race. But apparently, in the Christian tradition, the kind of, you know, overtly racist implications of that fact didn't develop in the same way as it developed in the Judaic tradition. According to the Talmud, Ham was the original African, and when God, through Noah, cursed Ham and his son Canaan and all his descendants, he was in fact cursing the African race. Now, this was the unique new element to the story that the Talmud originated, that the curse on Ham and Canaan was not only a curse on an individual and his family, but it was a curse on a race. So here, this is the contribution then of the Talmud, that God, through Noah, cursed the African race. And the Talmud proceeded to embellish the story in the most delightful, should I say, ways. For example, the Talmud said that there was ample proof that God was in fact cursing the African race. It said, for example, that because Ham had gazed upon Noah's nakedness in the dark of night, that the African race was henceforth turned black, so that the blackness of the African became a sort of a visible indication of that curse. The Talmud said that because it was dark at night when Ham entered that tent and looked upon his father's nakedness, he had to open his eyes, he had to buck his eyes, as they say in America, to see his father in the darkness. And that's why Africans had big eyes. The Talmud said, and here, and I'm going to quote all this exactly in a minute. You know, I'm not making this up. It sounds incredible, but I'm actually paraphrasing a gentleman by the name of Harold Brackman, a man who worked until recently for the Simon Wiesenthal Center of all agencies. He wrote all of this in his dissertation. And it might not surprise you to discover that once people like myself began quoting what this guy Brackman wrote, I'm sure you can guess what happened next. And that is that Brackman denied he had ever written this stuff. This stuff is in Brackman's PhD dissertation. It's called The Ebb and Flow of History. Anybody here can easily read it. You can get it in any library. If they don't have it, they'll get it for you into library loans. It's called The Ebb and Flow of History. It's a PhD dissertation, I think, in the history department at UCLA. 1977, by Harold D. Brackman, who I believe up to a couple of years ago, maybe even now, is or was until recently a functionary of the Simon Wiesenthal, or is it Wiesenthal Center. But despite the fact that his writings were clearly in the public record, that anybody, an undergrad student, can access this stuff and check it for themselves, once the story got out, he quickly denied it ever written this. This man actually wrote letters to the New York Times. I believe I have the actual footnotes here in the Jewish Onslaught concerning all this. This man wrote letters to the New York Times. He wrote a slew of letters to black publications all over this country denying all of this stuff, even though it's right there on the record. So I'm using very good evidence here when I paraphrase what he's saying. Brackman tells us that because, and here it gets to be totally hilarious. Now, these Jewish rabbis, the sages, they call them, wise men who put together this Talmud, they actually invented, they sort of elaborated on the biblical story. You know, it's like a jazz musician who improvises. Yeah. Well, they improvise on the story. They did a whole elaborate improvisation in the story. And somehow, Lord knows how come, but they came up with the notion that Ham, when he went into that tent and looked upon his naked father Noah, that Ham buggered his father. He had anal intercourse with his father. And because he had anal intercourse with his father, that's the reason, and here I'm citing Blackman, that's the reason why part of the curse was to give black men large sexual organs. So all of this was part of the curse. The black skin the big eyes, even the kinky hair too, big sexual organs, all of this. So, as amazing as this may seem, this transpired 1,000 years before the beginnings of the transatlantic slave trade. And when the slave trade came into being, this notion of the Hamitic curse was revived, and it became, both for Jews and for Christians, it became the most pervasive of all the attempts to rationalize that slave trade. Let me quote the exact words of Harold Bachman, lest you suspect that I'm making this up. I'm quoting here from Harold Bachman, the dissertation I mentioned a minute ago, The Ebb and Flow of History. Quote, there is no denying, this is on page 34 in case anybody who has a book feels like reading along with me. I know several of you have the book out there. But this is on page 34 in the middle of the page, second new paragraph. There is no denying that the Babylonian Talmud was the first source, and listen to how unequivocal he is here. It was the first, the very first. In other words, this is Bachman from the Simon Wiesenthal Center acknowledging that the Talmud was the one, was the place that invented the story of the Hamitic curse. There is no denying that the Babylonian Talmud was the first source to read a negrophobic content into the episode. Here he is referring to the episode of Ham looking upon his father's nakedness. He goes on to suggest that these early sages, some of them, you know, impose this homosexual spin onto the story. Quote, he says, Rab is one of these sages. He says, Rab maintained that Ham had unmanned Noah. So Ham, according to this sage, had actually castrated his father. While Samuel is some other sage, Samuel claimed that he had buggered him as well. Both unmanned him and buggered him. Now, how this arose out of the biblical story, I'll never understand. Let me continue to quote from Bachman here in his dissertation. Quote, he is discussing here various, slightly diverging, variants of this myth. He goes on to say, quote, the more important version of the myth, that's the Hamitic myth, however, ingeniously ties in the origins of blackness and of other real and imagined negroid traits with Noah's curse itself. According to it, that's according to this most popular version of the Hamitic myth, according to it, Ham is told by his outraged father that because you have abused me in the darkness of the night, your children shall be born black and ugly. This is in the Talmud. Because you have twisted your head to cause me embarrassment, they shall have kinky hair and red eyes. So if you ever wondered about the origin of the kinky hair and the red eyes of black folk, here you have it. Because your lips jested at my exposure, theirs shall swell. That's why black folks have thick lips. And because you neglected my nakedness, they, that is your children, the children of Ham and Canaan, they shall go naked with their shamefully elongated male members exposed for all to see. So there you have the origin of a whole variety of stereotypes pertaining to African folk. So the Hamitic myth then is where you really have to begin, you know, in terms of a discussion of the Jewish role in the slave trade. They provided the rationale par excellence for the prosecution of that slave trade. Some years after the Babylonian Talmud, sometime in the Middle Ages, a man who I believe they consider to be perhaps one of the greatest philosophers ever, a man by the name of Maimonides, actually also contributed to that notion of Africans being subhuman when in his famous book, Guide to the Perplexed, when he, Maimonides, suggested, again, that African people were less than human, but they were somewhere between monkeys and human beings. This is Maimonides, a man who is one of the most revered of all of these Jewish sages. So by the time then that the slave trade came along, then, you know, there was this tradition which had been floating around Europe, and it was seized upon then by the slave traders, Jews and Gentiles alike, as a basic rationale. There were other areas, you know, in which the Jewish presence was very manifest. For example, although I don't know a whole lot about this aspect of it, but my understanding is that Jews were in fact very prominent as slave traders, you know, in the centuries prior to the beginning of the Atlantic slave trade. My understanding is that Jews, you know, for many years sold Muslim slaves to Christians and sold Christian slaves to Muslims, and they were sort of accepted as the slave middlemen by both sides. And this is, you know, a long time before the Atlantic slave trade came about. The earliest multinational corporation involved in the Atlantic slave trade was something called the Dutch West India Company. And again, it often surprises people to discover that even in this early period, you know, globalization was already a very fairly entrenched phenomenon. The slave trade was a great example of globalization. Here you had the Dutch West India Company, out of Holland, of course, which went to West Africa. They had their own private army. They established forts on the West African coast. They had their own fleet of ships and so on. They had their own administrators. Sometimes they would govern areas. They had their own governors, administrators, and whatnot. They were almost like, it was almost like colonization, via private enterprise. It was like privatized colonization. And all of this, of course, transpired with the sanction of European governments. These were like surrogate governments almost, these chartered companies, as they were often called. So the Dutch West India Company, in the 1600s then, was the pioneer in this kind of multinational, globalized prosecution of the slave trade. And apparently a large number of the shareholders, the stockholders, in this Dutch West India Company were Jews. The Jews had been chased out of Portugal and Spain. They had been chased out of all kinds of places. They found some respite from their wanderings in Holland. They became an influential factor in Holland. And I've seen a variety of figures. This, too, is an area of some controversy. I've seen estimates varying from 25% to 50% concerning the stake of Jewish stockholders in the Dutch West India Company. But suffice it to say that they were an important element in the Dutch West India Company, which was the preeminent entity carrying on the slave trade in the early period. The Dutch West India Company was responsible for importing, you know, the earliest slaves to places like Brazil, to some parts of the Caribbean, either directly or indirectly, I think, to this country as well in a very early period in the 17th century. In many areas in the Americas, Jews were a dominant element in the slave trade. In Brazil, for example, in the 17th century, Jews were a dominant element in the slave trade. They owned a large number of the plantations. They were often very importantly positioned in other aspects, not necessarily the plantation aspects, but things like, say, the importation of slaves, things like the warehousing of slaves, things like the auctioning of slaves, things like the provisioning of slaves, things like manning slave ships, provisioning slave ships. In New England, for example, at the height of the Atlantic slave trade, rum became a major economic venture in New England, places like Providence, Rhode Island, places like Boston and so on. And rum was a major factor in the slave trade because rum was one of the major items of trade, one of the major items that, you know, slave ships carried when they went to West Africa to trade and exchange for slaves and so on. And I believe that at one point all the rum distilleries in Boston were owned by Jews. I think there was something like 18 or something like that rum distilleries. So in all of these areas, both directly and in terms of ancillary industries feeding the slave trade, Jews were very, very important. Apart from Brazil, Jews were again dominant factors in many other parts of the area. For example, in Curacao. Curacao, a Dutch island in the Caribbean, you know, the majority of folks involved in the slave trade in Curacao were Jews. At one point in Suriname, which again was a Dutch colony right next to Brazil in South America, Jews were again a very important part of the slave trade in Suriname. There was an English soldier by the name of John Steadman who went to Suriname in the late 1700s. As part of a mercenary force raised by the Dutch to try to fight against the Maroon slaves. Those were the escaped slaves who established an independent existence in the interior and gave the slave regime a lot of trouble. And Steadman wrote a very fascinating book concerning his experiences in Suriname, and there are several references in our Stedman's book to the presence of Jewish slave owners and so on. There was one large plantation area in Suriname called Jew Savannah, And according to Stedman, the Jews were very often the most cruel of the slave owners. They played a very prominent role in torturing slaves and so on. He has several little vignettes that he mentions concerning the kind of cruelties that were meted out to slaves by both Jewish men and women. There's one case he describes there of a Maroon slave leader, a man called Jolicoeur, French Jolicoeur. Beautiful heart. Don't know where he got that name from, Jolicoeur. But apparently Jolicoeur, again, was a rebellious slave. He led a slave uprising. And on one occasion, apparently, the Maroons were fighting against, you know, some of these people from Jew Savannah. And according to Stedman, they captured a Jewish slave owner named Schultz. And apparently Schultz was the man that Jolicoeur, you know, the slave owner that Jolicoeur had escaped from as a young boy. And Jolicoeur remembered that this guy Schultz had apparently ravaged his mother and so on. And Stedman describes a very, very, very harsh vengeance that was wrought by Jolicoeur on Schultz. He flayed him, cut his skin off, then used his skin to keep the powder dry, the powder for his cannon or whatever, and used his head to play football with.
Tune into our second annual Uhuru Radiothon Saturday and Sunday, May 5th and 6th. We continue to raise much-needed funds for improving the operations of your community radio station and the Burning Spear newspaper online. Joining us will be guests from Brooklyn to the Bahamas, from Guyana to Ghana, from St. Petersburg to St. Lucia, from Montserrat to Monrovia, from Senegal to Seattle, from Oakland to Orlando. This is your media, Uhuru News, Uhuru Radio. You can donate today by logging on to uhurunews.com as we rely on your support to get the truth out about our struggle for freedom. Join us during our live video broadcast of our Uhuru Radiothon Saturday and Sunday, May 5th and 6th at uhururadio.com. Uhuru means freedom. Uhuru. Tune into our second annual Uhuru Radiothon Saturday and Sunday, May 5th and 6th. We continue to raise much-needed funds for improving the operations of your community radio station and the Burning Spear newspaper online. Joining us will be guests from Brooklyn to the Bahamas, from Guyana to Ghana, from St. Petersburg to St. Lucia, from Montserrat to Monrovia, from Senegal to Seattle, from Oakland to Orlando. This is your media, Uhuru News, Uhuru Radio. You can donate today by logging on to uhurunews.com as we rely on your support to get the truth out about our struggle for freedom. Join us during our live video broadcast of our Uhuru Radiothon Saturday and Sunday, May 5th and 6th at uhururadio.com. Uhuru means freedom. Uhuru. Tune in to our second annual Uhuru Radiothon Saturday and Sunday, May 5th and 6th. We continue to raise much-needed funds for improving the operations of your community radio station and the Burning Spear newspaper online. Joining us will be guests from Brooklyn to the Bahamas, from Guyana to Ghana, from St. Petersburg to St. Lucia, from Montserrat to Monrovia, from Senegal to Seattle, from Oakland to Orlando. This is your media, Uhuru News, Uhuru Radio. You can donate today by logging on to uhurunews.com as we rely on your support to get the truth out about our struggle for freedom. Join us during our live video broadcast of our Uhuru Radiothon Saturday and Sunday, May 5th and 6th at uhururadio.com. Uhuru means freedom. Uhuru.
Jews were also very prominently present in non-Dutch parts of the Caribbean, places like Barbados, places like Jamaica, St. Thomas, and many of the other islands as well. That has arisen concerning, you know, whether Jews were the dominant element or not, or whether they were even an important element. But much of that discussion has taken place in the context of the United States of America. In the U.S., it may not be correct to say that slaves were as dominant in the slave trade as they were in parts of, say, the Caribbean or Central America. Nevertheless, Jews were an important part of the slave trade in this country, in the U.S. of A. Anyway, in fact, in the U.S. of A., Jews apparently played a role in the slave trade that was greater than their numbers in the overall population would suggest. Just as in 1992, a study done based on the Forbes magazine list of the richest people in America for 1992. A study based on that list discovered that something like 33% of the billionaires in the US of A were Jews, based on the Forbes list of 1992, at a time when Jews claimed to be 2.5% of the United States population. So just as in 1992 they were overrepresented in the high echelons of this country, just so during the slave trade, even though their numbers may have been relatively small, and many of the people who have tried to refute, you know, the suggestion that Jews were prominently involved in the slave trade in this country, many of those people have put forward figures suggesting that Jews were only a very minute portion of the overall American population. Yes, they were a very small percentage of the American population, but that has nothing to do with their role in the slave trade, the importance of their role. The role was much greater than the numbers in the overall population would suggest. As a matter of fact, a Jewish historian has done a study, 1830 census in the South, and has come up with the conclusion that something like 75% of Jewish households in the South in this country in 1830 owned slaves, whereas the percentage for white households generally was only something like 36%. So the Jews were approximately twice as likely as non-Jews, as a white population, to own slaves in this country, in the South, in 1830. So again, we're talking here about, you know, proportions rather than absolute figures. Some of the most important slave ship owners in colonial America were Jews. You know, perhaps the best known of these is a man called Aaron Lopez. And notice that many of these persons had Spanish or Portuguese-sounding last names, and that's because they were Sephardic Jews. When this whole question arose, you know, around my involvement in all this, many Jews were heard to say that there were no Jews in America prior to the 1880s. In fact, Nathan Glaser, a very famous academic out of Harvard University, who should know better, he actually wrote that there's no way that Jews could be responsible for the slave trade in America, since there were no Jews here, he said, before 1880. Of course, there were European Jews here in the 19th century before 1880, German Jews and so on. But there were Sephardic Jews here from the very beginning, you know, from the 17th century, there were Sephardic Jews coming in here to New York and later to other places. So hence the Spanish-sounding names, names like Nunez, names like Lopez, names like Castro, interestingly enough, names like Ferreira, Herrera, Gomez. All of these names, interestingly enough, suggested Jewish origin in colonial times. As somebody was saying to me yesterday, you could usually get a hint of their Jewishness from their first names. The last name might be Gomez or Nunez or Castro, but their first name might be Jacob or David or something like that.
Aaron.
So Aaron Lopez was out of Newport, Rhode Island. He was one of the largest slave ship owners in colonial America. This man had a fleet of ships for many years. He sent his ships to West Africa. They traveled from West Africa to the Caribbean, to Barbados, to Jamaica, St. Thomas, places like that. He had members of his family situated in the Caribbean. He had a whole network going on, and he brought slaves back here as well. Many of his slaves helped to build some famous synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island in colonial times. Despite the fact that, oh, by the way, Jews were also involved in other aspects of the trade. My time is running out, so I'm going to be quick here. For example, they were involved, again, in provisioning slaves here in this country, as they were in other areas as well, you know, providing the kind of coarse cloth that slaves wore, things like that. They had a hand in providing the kinds of restraints and handcuffs and chains and padlocks and those kinds of things that were used to sort of enforce servitude of the Africans as well. Interestingly enough, despite the prominence of Jews in this African slave trade in this country, in the US of A, their prominence in the African slave trade was not matched by a similar prominence in the abolitionist movement. In fact, some of the Christian abolitionists noted this apparent contradiction. In fact, let me quote you here a very interesting statement put out by Christian abolitionists. This is 1853. It's from the American and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society report, 1853. Quote, "The Jews of the United States have never taken any steps, whatever, with regard to the slavery question. As citizens, they deem it their policy to have everyone choose whichever side he may deem best to promote his own interests and the welfare of his country," etc., etc., etc. This statement concludes as follows, quote, "The objects of so much mean prejudice and unrighteous oppression as the Jews have been for ages, surely they, it would seem, more than any other denomination, ought to be the enemies of caste and friends of universal freedom." Such, however, was not the case. There were very few and far between as far as the abolitionist movement was concerned. So this then is the reality of Jewish involvement in the slave trade. And that's the reality that I faced then in 1993 when I stumbled into this controversy simply by exposing my students to the fact that Jews, like everybody else, had been involved. And of course, I did not deny the involvement of anybody else. I did not even deny the involvement of African collaborators. You know, for years I had taught Christian involvement. And up to now, I'm still somewhat surprised that everybody else, you know, seems willing to acknowledge their involvement in the trade. But for some reason, this is the only group that not only refuses to acknowledge the involvement, but becomes, you know, very, 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 very upset when that involvement is mentioned. I won't have time to go into my particular situation. It's all here in the Jewish onslaught. I'll just say very briefly before I wrap up, I was just told I have about 3 more minutes left. But this controversy assumed enormous proportions. I'm still surprised. You know, here was something as simple as my teaching this information, which is all well documented. The book that I was using, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, put out by the Nation of Islam, that book relies almost 100% on Jewish sources. But what is interesting, though, is that even though the Jewish academics and authoritative sources like the Encyclopedia, Judaica, even though these sort of academic, esoteric Jewish sources were quite forthcoming in acknowledging their role in the slave trade, the popular Jewish press and the popular Jewish populace, I guess, many of them were either unaware of all this or refused to believe it. I remember some Jewish alumni writing into the to the Wellesley College alumni magazine suggesting that my teaching, you know, the Jewish involvement in the slave trade was akin to suspending the rules of grammar in an English class. The end result of all this is that the role of Jews in the slave trade, something which was unknown to many folks prior to 1993, something which was largely unknown to me, because of the hullabaloo created by the Jewish media and so on, I think that has, in a sense, had an effect that they perhaps did not anticipate. And that is that something which was in fact a secret relationship is no longer secret. The whole world is now aware of the fact, thanks to the hullabaloo created by the Jewish media, of the Jewish involvement in the slave trade. And even though there has been an incredible effort since 1993 to, on the part of the Jewish media to sort of counterattack. For example, the Amistad movie was part of that counterattack. The Amistad movie very subtly suggested that Africans were the ones responsible for their own enslavement. The Amistad movie, put out by Steven Spielberg, actually had an African slave. Imagine this. Steven Spielberg actually had an African slave in the Amistad movie saying, I did not see the movie, by the way, I refused to see it, but I was told that Spielberg actually had an African slave in this movie saying that he was so sorry for the great suffering that, you know, the Jews had gone through, and whatnot, that nobody in the world, this was an African slave, a man who was on death row, in jail, fighting for his life as an African slave. And Spielberg has this man saying that he had just read the Bible, and these folks had suffered so much, etc. Nobody in the world had suffered as much as they had. The whole question of late, of an alleged slave trade in the Sudan. Now, there may indeed be a Muslim slave trade in the Sudan. There may, I know, it doesn't bother me one way or the other. But the whole attempt to elevate this into a new great anti-slavery crusade, that too is one of the means by which the Jewish establishment has tried to kind of cover up, their own involvement in the slave trade. I don't know how many books on the slave trade have been published by Jews in the last 6-7 years. I have lost count, but it could easily be a dozen. They keep just churning out these books. But the more noise they make, the more people become aware of the fact that, that there is a Jewish involvement in the slave trade. So I think that, to that extent, I think they have kind of shot themselves in the foot this time around. They have let the genie out of the bottle. Thank you. I've come from Jewish.
This is your Caribbean News in Brief, compliments of NewsAmericasNow.com. I'm Ken Webb. The 13th Annual Caribbean Conference on Sustainable Tourism Development wrapped up in Guyana. Rihanna takes the cover, and Usain Bolt is making plans for this summer in London. I'll be back after this. The Caribbean's most talked about investment forum returns to New York Marriott Marquis this June 6th to honor Virgin Group founder Sir Richard Branson as part of the Caribbean Tourism Organization's Caribbean Week in New York. Meet Sir Richard and other top Caribbean investors like Jay Yale, president of Solomon Energy, Jonathan Blue, chairman of Blue Equity, and U.S. hedge fund, pension fund, and money managers, real estate developers, and several ministers of government, all in one room. Log on to InvestCaribbeanNow.com and make your reservation. InvestCaribbeanNow.com. InvestCaribbeanNow.com. The 13th Annual Caribbean Conference on Sustainable Tourism Development wrapped up in Guyana on Wednesday, April 18th, with a call for member countries of the Caribbean Tourism Organization to adopt a development strategy that is sustainability-based. Welcoming some 140 delegates, observers, and media representatives to the conference, Guyana's tourism minister, Irfan Ali, said Sunday it was fitting that the STC-13 was being held in his country, regarded as the heart of ecotourism. As the host country of STC-13, Guyana became the first member country to host the conference for a second time, having hosted STC-4 in 2000. A panelist at the first Green Investment Forum of the Caribbean Tourism Organization's Sustainable Tourism Conference believes a waste-to-energy plant could help solve the problems of residents of Linden, Guyana. Lindeners in Guyana are on strike in the South American country to protest an imminent increase in electricity rates in the bauxite community. Official figures show that Lindeners pay between 5 and 15 Guyana dollars per kilowatt hours. Tony Fitty, president of the Waste to Energy Division and regional vice president for Europe and Africa, Nenovo Energy Inc., says a waste to energy plant in Guyana could lower the electricity costs tremendously. Fitty, a panelist on the forum organized by Felicia Passard's Heartbeat Communications and the CTO, added that his UK-based company will be building a plant in St. Kitts and soon adding St. Lucia in Jamaica to the regional investments as well. The forum also featured Loretto Duffy Mayers, project manager for the Caribbean Hotel Energy Efficiency Action Program, and Ujwal Beharaji, a specialist in renewable energy and energy efficiency with a focus on technology, investment and policy, and a consultant on the Chenac project. The conference was held at the Guyana International Conference Center in Liliendal, Guyana. Prasad, who co-convened and moderated the forum, urged the 100 delegates to remember that investing in clean energy is not just environmentally responsible, but good business.
Carib World News and News Americas Now recognizes WCAB 880 AM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Thank you for being part of our weekly family of stations.
On the ET scene, sexy Bayesian star Rihanna has made this year's Time Magazine 9th annual list of the 100 most influential people in the world. Rihanna was one of 38 women who made the list this year. The list, released on Wednesday, April 18th, also includes a diverse mix of bold-faced names from the entertainment world, politics, business, and more, including actors, entertainers, including 50 Cent, Warren Buffett, and Harvey Weinstein, and athletes, including Tim Tebow and Jeremy Lin. In sports, the fastest runner in the world happens to train with his stiffest competition. Usain Bolt of Jamaica, who is planning a second act at the 2012 Summer Olympics in London, is competing against fellow countryman Johan Blake, who is aiming to knock the king off his throne at the London Games, now just 100 days away. In 2009, Bolt set two more world records at the World Track and Field Championships in Berlin, running an outstanding 9.58 seconds in the 100 meters. And a 19.19 in the 200-meter race. Last summer, at the Diamond League meeting in Brussels, Blake ran the second-fastest 200-meter time ever at 19.26 seconds and was also the youngest sprinter ever to break the 10-second barrier for the 100-meter race. Bolt, however, does not seem worried, insisting the rivalry helps both young men push themselves in training and working harder together. That's this week's Caribbean News in Brief, compliments of NewsAmericasNow.com, and until next week, I'm Ken Webb.
This is Max Rameau with Take Back the Land and the Omojo Village. You are listening to UhuruRadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution.
Hi, I'm Alan Bomar Jones, and I encourage you to support the Uhuru Radio Network because it's independent, it's community, and it's pro-black.
Need to hear some soothing sounds of yesterday from around the world? Then listen to Golden Sunday Sounds with Ron Bob Semple every Sunday from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on the Uhuru Radio Network.
You're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple here on the Uhuru Radio Network.
On Sundays from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Sounds with me, Ron Bob Semple. A relaxing 3 hours of music from around the world. Music is the food of love. So tune in every Sunday evening from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Golden Sunday Sounds.
Get your news, views, and interviews which affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals by tuning into the Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple here on the Uhuru Radio Network.
Tune into Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 a.m. on the Uhuru Radio Network. We examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. If you're not listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network, then your radio is not on.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Hi, I'm Alan Bomar Jones, and you're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple.
Tune into our second annual Uhuru Radiothon Saturday and Sunday, May 5th and 6th. We continue to raise much-needed funds for improving the operations of your community radio station and the Burning Spear newspaper online. Joining us will be guests from Brooklyn to the Bahamas, from Guyana to Ghana, from St. Petersburg to St. Lucia, from Montserrat to Monrovia, from Senegal to Seattle, from Oakland to Orlando. This is your media, Uhuru News, Uhuru Radio. You can donate today by logging on to uhurunews.com, as we rely on your support to get the truth out about our struggle for freedom. Join us during our live video broadcast of our Uhuru Radiothon, Saturday and Sunday, May 5th and 6th, at uhururadio.com. Uhuru means freedom. Uhuru.
they said, free the bloody slave. I was then put out on the street. I had no clothes, I have no food, I have no place to sleep. I had no education, no particular ambition. This I cannot conceal. Forgot my native culture, live like a vulture. From the white man I had to steal, because he made me work. I said I work.
Well, welcome back to Caribbean Forum here on the Uhuru Radio Network. I'm Ron Bob Semple, and joining me this morning is an international business consultant and former senior Caribbean ambassador, Sir Ronald Saunders. Sir Saunders, good morning and welcome to Caribbean Forum.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
It is a pleasure speaking with you, sir, and I know you are in the land of Bimshire, and I'm sure you're basking in probably some sunshine.
Yes, and cricket about to start between Australia and the West Indies, and tomorrow it's something to look forward to.
Absolutely, I'm sure it is. Now, 2012 marks 50 years since the end of the West Indies Federation, which came into being in January of 1958 and was dissolved in May of 1962. Recently, you participated in a Caribbean conference entitled 50-50, Surveying the Past, Mapping the Future. Sir Saunders, give us your overall impression of the conference, and how does the future of the region look to you?
Well, our region is in difficulty. Most of the world, of course, is facing a severe financial crisis. But the Caribbean is particularly in a difficult situation. And it's not only because of the global financial crisis, but because of policies that have been pursued by a number of countries prior to that global financial crisis coming into being. Mm-hmm. For instance, even before October 2008, when that crisis started globally, a number of countries in the Caribbean were already very highly indebted, to the extent that we now have 10 of the 14 independent, well, 10 of the 13 English-speaking Commonwealth Caribbean countries are amongst the most highly indebted in the world on a per capita basis. And that's really quite a frightening thought. It means that the debt-to-GDP ratio, the amount of debt they're carrying, when you compare it to their gross domestic product, is so high that it is very burdensome and very troubling. And it affects the amount of policy space that's available to any government to spend the kind of money on the things that are necessary to enhance the well-being of people.
Right.
That would include, for instance, education, health, the building of roads, the provision of health facilities, such as hospitals and equipment, and of course schools, and providing schools with the equipment that they need for training children in skills that are relevant to today's age. But then there's the matter, of course, also of defense and security. The Caribbean, as you know, is one of the most porous areas for the transshipment of narcotics. And the Caribbean, as a result of that, has become very porous. The number of drug wars, turf wars we've seen between drug traffickers and people who ship the stuff is really quite alarming. In fact, most of the people in prisons in the Caribbean are there because of drug-related crimes. So, you know, we've got a difficult situation, and we shouldn't pretend that it is anything else. And the most troubling of it all is that unemployment levels are rising.
Right.
In some of the smaller countries of the Caribbean, it's as high as 20%. In others, it's you know, it's no lower than 10 or 12. And the alarming part about that is that the unemployment amongst youth is twice that number. So that if you've got an overall unemployment level of let's say 20%, the group that is most affected would be young people, and their contribution to that number, when measured, is double it. So, you know, it is a frightening thought, and kids are coming out of school with no prospect of a job.
You just mentioned... Yes, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, the only country of the English-speaking Caribbean right now that seems to be an exception to this rule is Guyana, which over the last 6 years has had continuous growth of about 4% and rising, and whose natural resources has really come into play. Right. So that what the country earns now from the mining of gold and other mineral extracts, manganese, for instance,
right,
bauxite coming back into their own, has really pushed the economy along. We've got as many as 27 Canadian companies, for instance, now involved in mining in Guyana in one way or another, at a larger scale than has been done before. And providing this continues, Guyana is the one area of brightness on the Caribbean economic landscape.
That's great to hear. You mentioned a little while ago of the Caribbean region being a hub for the drug trafficking. Sir Saunders, what are the heads of government doing specifically to stem this tide?
Well, this is an issue that has commanded their attention now for over a decade, probably longer. The difficulty is that the amount of money that is involved in the transshipment of drugs is so vast that even the United States of America finds it difficult to fight it. So that when you come to small countries in the Caribbean, they really have a great deal of difficulty. And the truth of the matter is that were it not for external assistance from the United States and Canada and the United Kingdom,
right,
For the provision of Coast Guards and for their own involvement, of course, in drug interdiction in the Caribbean, the problem would be much greater. The Caribbean simply does not have enough Coast Guards. It simply does not have enough helicopters. It simply does not have enough surveillance planes to be able to deal with this matter in the way that they could.
And I'm sure advantage is being taken because of that.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. the point is that what they're doing is that the drug traffickers find the most vulnerable areas they can to move their drugs. And in any event, the Caribbean is geographically smack in the middle of where drugs are produced in South America and where they end up in either Europe or North America. So, you know, it's almost a problem of geography as much as anything else. But really, the point is that the Caribbean doesn't have the capacity to fight the problem by itself. And even with external help, it is a very difficult proposition.
Why did the West Indies Federation not work?
Ignorance, basically. Same kind of ignorance, unfortunately, that prevails today that stops the Caribbean community and common market from becoming a more integrated process than it is. And that is that, you know, there are political people, political elites throughout the Caribbean who have some benefit to derive from keeping their countries as separate units, because in a separate unit, they are a big fish in a little bowl. And if the bowl were bigger, they may be either smaller fish or may not exist at all. And the result of that is that those big fish frequently try to convince their populations that the integration of the Caribbean would not be a good thing. For instance, Sir Alexander Bustamante, who was at one point the leader of the Jamaica Labour Party in Jamaica during the West the days of the West Indies Federation, told his people two things about why it is they should vote in a referendum against the West Indies Federation. He said, one, Jamaica would end up paying for the survival of these fall islands. That's how he put it. And secondly, he said that Jamaica would be overrun by these small islanders, all of whom would come to Jamaica to live and work. Now, you know, the truth is, when you look back at that situation now, it is Jamaicans who have left Jamaica to go to smaller islands of the Caribbean.
That's right.
Over the last 50 years. So it's been a complete reverse of what Bustamante had said. And Jamaica has certainly not paid the way for these countries whose per capita income is now higher than Jamaica's. So, you know, it was ignorance on which they played in Jamaica on that issue. In Trinidad and Tobago, the reason why Eric Williams, who was then the Prime Minister of Jamaica, took Trinidad out of the West Indies Federation was that after Jamaica made the decision that it would leave on the basis of that referendum I just talked about, Williams had the most amazing arithmetic, because there were 10 countries in the Federation at the time, and his arithmetic was that one from 10 leaves naught. So that he saw a zero-sum game at the end of that process. But his real concern was that with Jamaica out of it, Trinidad and Tobago would have had to carry the burden of all of the other countries, because it was far better off than they were.
Okay.
And you must remember that neither Guyana nor Belize were part of the West Indies Federation. They had opted long ago not to be part of it, so it was really the islands of the Caribbean, English-speaking islands of the Caribbean, that were part of that process. Now, Guyana didn't get itself involved in the West Indies Federation for a number of reasons. One of them had to do, I suspect, with feelings of race, where the Indian community in Guyana were encouraged to believe that, again, if they became part of the West Indies Federation, they too would be overrun and minimized, and their views not taken account of. But there were other factors too. There was a very strong feeling for an independent Guyana, which had struggled for its independence much longer and through a much more difficult process than other countries in the West Indies. It had their constitution suspended in 1953.
Right.
Dr. Jagan, who was then the leader of the People's Progressive Party, and his wife were sent to jail. There were all those factors that played in this. But at the end of the day, it was basically a lack of education, a lack of information, a lack of understanding that by themselves, each of these places were too small
right,
to go it alone.
Yes.
As independent countries.
Speaking of these CARICOM nations, Anguilla, Bermuda, British Virgin Islands, Cayman Islands, Montserrat, and Turks and Caicos are all non-independent nations and under British rule. During your recent lecture, sir, on the UCCI campus in the Cayman Islands, you said, quote, "The urge for independence is often present among small and vocal groups who link their non-independent status to slavery, exploitation, and racism, and who regard formal political independence as a defining end to that experience," unquote. Could you expound on that for us, please, sir?
Well, you know, it's a natural feeling. If there are groups within these countries who do link the fact that they are still colonies to the past, to the fact that slavery is what brought them there, that their ancestors were exploited by plantation owners and so on, and that they were ruled from Britain, and they feel that, you know, this is all tied up together, and that by getting rid of the British, they will somehow have released themselves from this yoke of oppression. Well, you know, the truth is, for those countries, the fact that they have been British colonies has really helped them, not hindered them. And I say this because in each of those countries, with the exception of Montserrat, which has had its fair share of natural catastrophes, of course, with more than half the island now uninhabited because of the Soufriere Hills volcano and its eruption in 1995, which, you know, just destroyed it. But if you look at all of the others, Bermuda, Cayman, Turks and Caicos, they have higher per capita incomes than the rest of the Caribbean. Now, if you take the independent countries, the Bahamas, in the independent Commonwealth countries, is the country that has the highest per capita income at around $40,000. No, I'm sorry, at around $30,000 per annum. Bermuda's per capita income is $70,000. So you can see the difference of the earning capacity.
Absolutely.
In the Cayman, it's $50,000. So these small non-independent countries have a higher rate of income than the richest of the independent Caribbean countries. And if you compare them, for instance, with Guyana, even though Guyana is doing so well economically now, the rate of income between the people of Bermuda and the people of Guyana is 23 times difference. So that shows you that that you know these countries have not done badly, and they've not done badly despite the fact that they don't have the natural resources of many of the other countries that you would have thought would have exploited it.
All the more so, Sanders, if the Federation had really worked. And these independent nations had come together with their richness and their natural resources and their bauxite and their rice and sugar. Just imagine how powerful that region could have been today.
Yes, exactly, because it would have been it is an extremely wealthy region. Problem is that its resources are separated in over a wide area, and it just is not integrated in terms of production.
Right.
So we've got bauxite in Guyana, we've got oil in Trinidad and Tobago, and yet we've never been able to produce aluminium and smelt it. And the reason for that is that we won't combine Guyana's bauxite with Trinidad's oil in order to produce a smelting plant that would give us a finished product. You know, all of that is shipped out. And it's so, of course, as well for Jamaica. But if we were to combine all of the natural resources we have in agriculture, in minerals, even in tourism and financial services. So you take the expertise, for instance, of Barbadians, the money of the Trinidadians, so the natural resources of Guyana and Jamaica. You could understand that if we could integrate that production,
mm-hmm.
we could be producing stuff that would make us competitive in the world. But other than that, what we are doing is that we are the producers of raw materials, and the value added is being done outside of our region, and the people who are really making the money are not where the natural resources are to start with.
Absolutely.
And we continue to confound this in the Caribbean community and common market by not having the kind of freedom of movement of labor and capital and goods and services that we require. In other words, if the whole area were to pull down its borders and say, you know, this Caribbean region is now one country with free movement of people and free movement of capital and free movement of goods and services, and companies would begin to start to amalgamate, so you don't have a Jamaican company or a Trinidadian company.
Sorry.
You have a Caribbean company.
One Caribbean.
Then, you know, you've got something you can really play with. Now, you know, again, in playing on fears of people, what they say is, but who's going to stop the criminals from moving from one country to another? Well, what stops criminals from moving within the United States now from one state to another? They are stopped because of border knowledge and so on. In fact, what you would have is, if not one police force, at least certainly a central police force where all of this information is available. And therefore, you know when these kinds of people are traveling and how they're traveling. But, you know, again, I come back to it. It's fear that people play on. And until we can overcome that fear and begin to understand that the Caribbean is indeed one region and should be one people with the production, integration of their production, of their capacities, of their human resources, and of their knowledge, we could be far better off than we are.
If you've just joined us here on Caribbean Forum, my special guest this morning is Sir Ronald Sanders. He was appointed as one of 10 members of an eminent persons group which was requested by Commonwealth heads of government to recommend options for reform that will sharpen the impact of the 53-nation Commonwealth, strengthen its networks, and raise its profile. Sir Sanders, you currently reside in Barbados, whose government recently invited the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights to discuss implementing the protection of all human rights. Is this a regional concern?
Well, I don't know very much about that. I have to say, I don't live in Barbados all the time. I just happen to be there now.
Okay.
but I know the Human Rights Commissioner was visiting.
Right.
And I don't know quite why Barbados or what is happening with that issue in the region. But what I can say is that the issue of human rights is one that to which all Caribbean governments have subscribed in international conventions. We do know that there is abuse of it from time to time.
Right.
And one would hope that the governments of the Caribbean would continue to uphold it. There has been some slippage in some areas, and it is good to know that there are international agencies that are looking at it closely so that when slippages occur, they are able to intervene and suggest to governments that they need to improve either the law or the enforcement of the law or the practices that that we see being infringed from time to time.
There appears to be total chaos in the Caribbean when it comes to accessibility to air transportation getting to and from neighboring islands in the region. So Saunders, the latest victim being RedJet Airlines. What's causing this?
Well, a very important part of the Treaty of Chaguaramas, the treaty that established the CARICOM, the Caribbean Community and Common Market, was an undertaking to rationalize air services in the region so that people of the region could benefit from it, but more than that, so that tourism could benefit from it. And so, too, could be the movement of goods. You know, we've got, if you think about it, a great production of food in Guyana and in Belize and in Dominica and to a certain extent in Jamaica and Trinidad and Tobago. And the production of food in those places, and I'm talking about fruits and vegetables and meats and you name it, would be able to supply the needs of the Caribbean people. Instead of that, most of the islands of the Caribbean import their food from Miami. And therefore, they make themselves vulnerable to a problem should, for any reason, that food supply be cut off. But to move that food, we need air transportation. It would be good if we had sea transportation as well for perishable items, but we don't. But it would be good to have air transportation that did it, and we don't do it. To get, for instance, from Barbados, where I happen to be at the moment, to Belize, I would have to
Could take 2 days.
I'd have to travel to Miami. I'd have to either leave very, very early in the morning to get there and spend a few hours in Miami before flying on to Belize, or I would have to overnight in Miami in order to get there. You know, there are no direct links that brings one from Belize to, let's say, Jamaica, which is a very close point, and then down to the Caribbean chain. It does make for very great difficulty. But the other point is that it's becoming increasingly more expensive. What Caribbean people are complaining about, for instance, is that it costs more to travel from Barbados to Guyana than it does to travel from Barbados to New York.
I remember a couple of years ago I was in Barbados and I had some time and wanted to, you know, fly to Guyana for a couple of days, and I was quoted a price of almost $600.
Yep, and that's the reality, I'm afraid. So, you know, one of the problems is the cost of these flights. Now, one understands the cost is linked. The cost is linked to a number of things. If you ever examine your ticket, you'd find, for instance, that the cost between Guyana and Barbados of travel is $153. That's the ticket cost. But then attached to that is government taxes.
Yep.
Out of Barbados, which is almost the cost of the ticket again.
That's it.
And then you've got to pay VAT on the ticket out of Barbados. And then you've got to pay... you've got to pay a surcharge for oil. So at the end of the day, your ticket is pretty much up to that $600 figure you just called. Now, governments, of course, have to maintain airports, and one understands that, but they have airport taxes. But in addition to the airport taxes, they have this ticket, this extra money, that is taxes that are charged on your ticket. And then there's the value-added tax that they put on top of that. And so it adds up. So they make a big contribution to the cost of travel. If the taxes were reduced, the cost of travel would be reduced along with it. But the cost of oil is also going up, of course.
Absolutely.
And while one understands that, most of these airlines have what they call a fuel surcharge on your ticket. So to say that because the cost of fuel is going up, it makes it difficult for them to bring their prices down, they do charge you a fuel surcharge. And that would one is what the customer recognizes. All of us have to pay to help meet that fuel bill. But there's still no justification for the cost to be as high as it is.
I think it's a very, very good point, Sasandas, that you made a little earlier with regard to the intertransportation between the islands, not just for human flying back and forth, but also the goods and the fruits and the vegetables that need to go from island to island. And that could be disrupted, and you know, because of perishable goods and so on, that could just cost a bundle to those who are supplying these products. Before I let you go, Sasandas, recently, within the last 6 weeks, the world, the United States, and the world at large has been buzzing about the senseless and the unfortunate killing of young Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. As a son of the Caribbean, Sasandas, could you speak to our young people? I don't know if this case is being discussed in your travels in the Caribbean among parents and our young people.
Well, it is a case that's being discussed, but of course there's no great similarity between what happened with Trayvon Martin in Florida and young people in the Caribbean, in the sense that he seemed to be, and I say seemed to be because I don't know the facts of the matter.
Right.
He seemed to be a victim of an over-anxious neighborhood watch person who, despite the police cautioning him not to follow Trayvon Martin, continued to do so, clearly because he suspected him of something. For what reason, other than the fact that he was black and wearing a hood, God alone knows. But the fact that he followed him, and then whatever incident occurred at the end of it ended up in the admitted killing of Trayvon Martin.
Right.
I really don't think we would have that kind of thing in the Caribbean. That was born, it seems to me, out of an inherent kind of racial prejudice, even a societal developed prejudice. Our difficulties in the Caribbean for young people is more gang-related stuff, again, which they borrow from the culture of the United States, having seen these gangs develop in America and seen what they do on television. I'm afraid rap music and its extolling of some of these virtues doesn't help matters either. But that's one area of you know, where it is a problem. But it's not so big a problem in all of the Caribbean countries. And I have to say, in those countries where it had become a problem, we've seen a minimization of it now, and one must thank God for that. But I don't think that we would have exact parallels between the Trayvon Martin story and what's happening in the Caribbean. I really don't know what you do about that situation in the United States of America. I would have hoped that the American people showing the fact that they could see beyond color in electing a president of the United States of America who is a man himself of color, that would have helped to ameliorate the racial bigotry and prejudice that had gripped that nation for centuries. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to have spread itself effectively across everyone in the nation. And therefore, these pockets of poverty, of prejudice and bigotry continue, and the manifestations of them are not only the fact that Trayvon Martin was admittedly killed by George Zimmerman in some form of altercation, but the fact that the police didn't seem to have investigated this matter in a proper and thorough fashion.
Absolutely not. There's no documented evidence as far as his clothing.
Yeah. Well, you see, again, one wonders whether that is not a result of prejudice and bigotry, and whether if they had done the job properly,
absolutely,
and had been able to present the country, and I say the country because this has gone beyond Florida now.
Oh, it's now global, yes.
With the facts of what occurred.
Would not have been need for speculation.
Exactly. People might then have been able to say, okay, I understand what happened. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate, but this is what happened. And, you know, justice will be done one way or the other. But, you know, police, as far as I'm concerned, didn't handle this matter very well. And why they didn't handle it very well is a huge question, because we know the statistics indicate that the larger number of people who are arrested in the United States in a disproportionate way are black people. And therefore, one has to speculate whether if Trayvon Martin was white and George Zimmerman was black, whether they would have had the same results. Now, that is pure speculation on my part, and I don't want to fuel the fire more than this has already been fueled. But it would be good if at some point the police were to be able to put the resources behind this investigation that it really requires, bring a speedy conclusion to it, a thorough conclusion, even though swift, so that people could really understand what the facts of the matter are. I think this would go a long way to, you know, easing the kind of emotional involvement and frustration that people feel right now.
My special guest this morning has been Sir Ronald Michael Saunders, an international business consultant and a former senior Caribbean ambassador. Sir Saunders, thank you very much for spending this half an hour with us here on Caribbean Forum. And please enjoy that first digital cricket match between the West Indies and Australia. Should I ask you, who do you like?
Well, I need not really answer that question.
I don't expect
other than to say I'm a West Indian born and I will be a West Indian die, and whatever they do, I will back them whoever they play against.
I didn't expect you to answer that, sir. Thank you very much, Sir Saunders.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
One heart. water now. Caribbean. One Caribbean people.
Oh, Caribbean.
One bride, one destiny.
Oh, yes.
Are coming together.
Oh, yes.
Hands across the water.
Oh, Caribbean.
One flag on the island.
Oh, Caribbean.
Everybody come on now.
Oh, yes.
One spirit. One love, one earth, one destiny. Yeah, 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 yeah. Hands across the water.
Shout, I love you. Tell me all the passion gone. I love you.
ve ma ta mo ra no abaya student de o wa school ge wa gwa njiro lu be wa ma we am abi gba school we na be direct.
It's time to cut the ribbon and open the school doors. As we entered the classroom, what struck us first was how dark it was even during the daytime.
Can we unblock that because there's not enough light coming in here? If you can step from the door, then we can have more light coming in. You say hello?
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 Hello? Can you say Uhuru?
Uhuru!
Say that, huh? Oh. Can you say one Africa?
One Africa.
Can you say that?
One Africa.
Ooh. Say it again, please.
Jackson Blue and White, the town's youth marching band, is getting ready to lead the way of the procession. The vocational students and their children are getting ready to lead the way as well.
Sebe bana yango, panana yo na mputu, salama kabumayo Ngana zongi selibango kongo kino liwa Nako bunde la bosembo pona bandeko banga Makila mazali kotanga mokili ebo ikomona Iwa ya moto moyindu wa ezali eloko pamba Lelo batindi yo, obo mandeko na yo Lobi bako tinda mususu, ayako boma yo Lobi, mwano zali na yo kakali, changa moko ya mai Nakati ya biliki, olingo bongo lani
Lingo obo landa kabiso na mbonge topesi bino uru ndenge pa na biso ezalaka na banzi bino nyoso bozali malamu pe na baninga oyo balanda kabiso na tango nyoso tosepeli penza kozala na bino a toza na sangwa sika kopesa bino kasi liboso to banda na kopesa nanu uru na ndeko na ngatunde.
Oh, pelo sako ndeko wabuza, matondo mengi lolenge,